All right. Well, join me in 1 Corinthians 7. 1 Corinthians 7. We'll see how far we get tonight. It's been a challenging passage to study. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is where we are. Of course, you know, we've been walking through this book with a few breaks here and there. Let's see. 1 Corinthians 7, we're going to be picking it up in verse 8. And the plan was to get down to verse 16. So let me at the very least read this section that goes together. And let me actually start up in verse 1. Okay? We'll read down, just get a bit of the big context here, and I'll make a few comments as we get into our text, because I know it's been a couple weeks. So Paul gets to this point in the letter, and he begins to answer some very pointed questions that the Corinthians had been writing to him about. And this first one, as you'll notice, is about sex and marriage, marital intimacy and marriage relationships. So that's what he seeks to address in the first half of this chapter. Let's read it together. "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife," or keep having, remember? We talked about last time. "And each woman is to keep having her own husband." In other words, continue in marital intimacy with your own husband or wife. So he's speaking to married couples. "The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have the authority over his own body, but the wife does. So stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." We'll come back to that verse. "But this I say, by way of concession, not of command, yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." And from here, he begins to enumerate then all the different circumstances and gifts in which God has given to these people. And notice, in the following verses down, as we read through verse 16, he's going to start applying this truth about marriage and intimacy to specific groups of people. Notice, beginning verse 8, "But I say, now to the unmarried and to widows, that it is good for them if they remain even as I. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn." Now, "with passion" there in the italics is not actually an original text, which is why it's in italics. So, but, verse 10, another group, second specific group addressed, "To the married I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife." Third group, third category, verses 12 through 16. "But to the rest I say, not the Lord, but that I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who's an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise, your children are unclean, but now they are holy. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not in bondage, is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife?" You know, I've been talking to Carrie about this passage. He did a series not long ago on marriage, singleness, divorce, and remarriage, and he's worked through this, and ages ago he taught through 1 Corinthians, and here was his comment to me. He said, of all the passages in 1 Corinthians, including the baptism of the dead section, this he deems the hardest. So, and I think Kevin was just telling me earlier in my office that MacArthur, when he was asked of all the passages in the New Testament that he felt like could have been clearer, or he could have had there, we could have had more information on, he referenced this passage on divorce and remarriage. So, all of that to say, on the front end, as you could probably imagine, as we get into all of this, look, all of your lives probably have been touched by any number of these circumstances. And there are a myriad of scenarios that are just left unaddressed here. There are a myriad of scrambled eggs, as Carrie likes to call them, situations in which you just, you try to come to this passage and you try to apply these principles, and it's just difficult. And it's difficult. So that's my qualification for walking into this. And yet, I do want you to be encouraged, because I do believe that obviously, 2 Timothy 3:16, we have this in Scripture for a reason. And there is a lot of clarity that we can have from this passage. And you might be sitting there saying, as you were listening to this, like, well, man, that sounds a lot like we're just talking about marriage, we're just talking about divorce, and yet none of us are married, and none of us are divorced, and or none of us are in that specific circumstance. You're on Friday night here, Kevin. What relevance does this passage have for me as a young adult, perhaps as a single person? And I would just say this. Here's what, when you back up and you look at this chapter, I would say it's not just a passage about marriage, singleness, and divorce, and remarriage. It's interesting. This is the only chapter in all of Scripture that helps us to navigate specifically how we can move from one of those categories to another one of those categories in a God-honoring way, in a way that pleases Him. And because of that, it's so relevant to you. In other words, even if you're not married, even if you've never been married, if you've ever wondered whether you should pursue marriage or change your marital status, this chapter is relevant. If you've ever wondered if you should just stay single, then this chapter is relevant. 1 Corinthians 7 is unique in that sense. It is, of all the chapters in your Bible, the one place where we get the most inspired detail about how, when, and why a Christian, listen, should perhaps seek to change their relationship status. I'm not talking about Facebook at this point. From single to married, or even in some cases from married to single, in a way that pleases Christ. And so there are principles laden in here that I think will be encouraging, that we can land on and we can take away. So needless to say, you know, look, here's another reason why you need to understand this chapter, because there's so much confusion and debate out there even in the church about how to think about singleness and marriage in light of how God has wired each one of us, in light of the providential circumstances in which you find yourself, in light of even eternity. The fact that marriage is temporary, it's for this life only. How do we think about that? Does that change our perspective, and should that change our desire for companionship? All of this Paul addresses here. And people, I have heard so many young adults, especially confused, but I've also heard married people confused about and justified pursuing one thing or another for very worldly and unbiblical reasons. And 1 Corinthians 7 is going to help us navigate those. It's going to help us dissect our motives. And here are just some of the questions that it touches. Which is better, marriage or singleness? Why choose one over the other? Is there a holier option? Is there a more Christian option? What is the gift of singleness? Should coming to Christ, should being converted, becoming a new creature, a new creation, change our desires and goals and pursuits in this area? If we're single, should we pursue marriage? What does the Bible say? If we come to Christ but we're already married, should we go back to being single? What if we're married to an unbeliever? What do we do? What if in our past we've had multiple marriages and now we've come to Christ? What does God call me to do? These are all questions that this chapter touches. So you can see already just how relevant it is, even if you may not find yourself relating or fitting into some of these specific categories. You need to know this chapter. You need to know the truth here. Paul is going to help us navigate these kinds of questions and more. Okay, so that's just to get you to pay attention. Let me do this first, just by way of setting the context and the big picture. I know we've walked through verses 1 through 7 already last time, but I want to make some observations first about this chapter and its main point and Paul's answer to some of these questions. In other words, where does Paul begin? What is the baseline assumption that he makes for people who have come to Christ in a pagan culture and are now asking the question, what do I do about romance? What do I do about marriage? What do I do about my situation? What is Paul's perspective on being married and being single from this chapter now that you have come to Christ? Well, let me ask you this. I want to hear from you, actually. For those of you who are familiar with 1 Corinthians 7, when you think of 1 Corinthians 7, how would you answer that question? What is Paul's perspective on marriage and singleness? Which is better?
I wish Huxley was here.
Why?
He has thoughts.
Oh, really? He has thoughts? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't help us because he's not. He's in Houston. So what would you say, if for those of you who know the chapter, Fiona?
I am not an expert, but...
That's okay. I'm just asking for interaction, not expert interaction.
So, what I would say is, he's not saying that one is better, he's just presenting each as the characteristics of both, and there's more. About divorce and stuff, but he's he's just contrasting them. He's not saying that one is better.
Okay.
Holier.
Good, Tim.
I would just say, building off of that, Paul talks about how each singleness and marriage present their own advantages and disadvantages in ministry.
Yep.
Your own with Christ.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, you guys are spot on. I mean, there are benefits to both. The approach that Paul has when you just zoom out in this chapter is this. The answer is, well, to the question, which is better for the Christian? The answer is, well, it depends. It depends. And even this, on the providence of God, it depends. And notice that Paul's starting point and the baseline counsel that he gives throughout this entire chapter, I'll give you two summary statements to help you just know where to start with him, okay? As you look at what his counsel is, where he starts with all of these scenarios, do you know what the command is in every single one of these, to the married, to the unmarried, to the rest, and even in verse 25 later on to virgins who've never been married? Do you know what his baseline starting point is? Remain as you are. Wherever God saved you in his providence, be content with that. Start there. Remain as you are. In other words, what does that tell me? That tells me that neither singleness nor marriage is more Christian than the other. So here, both singleness and marriage in this chapter are presented by Paul as equally a grace gift from God. Look at verse 7. Remember? He said, "Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself," which he was single at the time. And yet, he says, look, however, each man has his own gift from God, his own grace gift. One in this manner and the other in that. And they're both, singleness and marriage, are considered graces given by God. In other words, neither one is inherently better than the other, more holy, more Christian. It depends, Paul says, on your circumstances. And I already mentioned this, but the first principle where he begins is both singleness and marriage are equally a grace gift. The second is this, just to help you understand where he begins. Then his conclusion is, if possible, Christians should remain as they are in the providence of God. Look at verse 17. Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each, in this manner let him walk. Look at verse 20. Each man must remain in that condition in which he was called. Look at verse 24. He says, brethren, each one is to remain with God in that condition in which he was called. In other words, here's what Paul is saying, like, wherever God saved you, that's your starting point. And it's okay. If you're married, when God saved you, then the baseline is, if you're able, then remain married. If you're single and God saves you, he'll say also it's good that you remain single. And yet, he does now through the rest of the chapter begin to give exceptions to that. He doesn't prohibit changing those circumstances, but he does encourage and warn against unbiblical ways of doing so, unbiblical motives for doing so. And so the default for each one is to remain or stay in the providential condition in which God saved them, because God's grace is sufficient for that condition, which tells me neither singleness nor marriage is the issue, but glorifying God in your circumstances. Look at verse 18 and 19. This will wrap up our setting of the context here. Notice, and we'll get into this when we get to that point, but a little bit more. He says there, was any man called when he was already circumcised? He's not to become uncircumcised. Has anyone been called in uncircumcision? He's not to be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. And here it's the key. But what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. You see his point there? Singleness is nothing. Marriage is nothing. But what matters is keeping the commandments of God. Which is why from here on, you zoom out for the rest of the chapter, he begins to tackle circumstances. And he begins, his baseline is always, remain as you are if you're able. But from there, he allows for a change in your relationship status. That's not the issue. The issue is, why are you doing that? The issue is, how are you doing that? And so that's what we begin to study tonight. And there are a multitude of scenarios that he doesn't address. And we're just going to have to be content with that. But having set forth then in the first part here, what a healthy, intimate relationship in marriage is ideally supposed to be like, right? We looked at that last time, verses 1 through 7. Get to verse 8 now, through 16. And Paul begins to apply that teaching to three specific categories of people. And I already know we're not going to cover all three of them tonight. Three specific categories of people now, beginning in verse 8, who are all, I would say, related to marriage in some way. That's critical. They're all related to marriage in some way. Notice what the categories are, and I know I'll have to explain the first one especially. But I'll just say this. Let me give them to you, and then the next 2 weeks we'll walk through them. The first category we find in verses 8 and 9. Notice, but I say to the unmarried and to the widows. And I'm going to just categorize that as the previously married. I'll have to explain that and prove that to you, why I take that to mean the previously married. The second category is verses 10 and 11. To the married, he says. And we'll just categorize that as the equally married. The equally married. In other words, this is likely referring to Christian married to Christian. Okay? And then the last category, verses 12 through 16, we'll call the unequally married. And he calls it to the rest, but as you go, as you continue to read, he's clearly referring to those who are Christians married to unbelievers. That's what he means by the rest here. Okay? Which is one reason why I said that these categories have in view people as related to marriage. And I'll have to explain that. I know I'll have to explain that in verse 8. So let's just try to tackle that first category, okay? The previously married in verses 8 and 9. And since we're only going to try and tackle maybe one of them, let me interact with you a little bit on this. When you read this, verse 8, but I say to the unmarried and to the widows, what do you think? Tim? Do you?
Yeah, because I think of not married would mean you've never been married. Unmarried means you were married.
Okay. Well, you just stole my thunder. It's okay. I would say a lot of people would even put myself in that situation, this situation. I have my initial reading before studying this would have been that the unmarried were describing those, just the broadest category of single people, right? Anybody would have been there? Okay, let's just be honest, okay. Including those who'd never been married before, right? And, but I'm going to be arguing, like as Tim so eloquently stole my thunder, that actually this is a category of those who've been divorced that's paired with people who've lost their spouses due to death. So this verse 8, I would be saying, and I'll give you my reasons here in a minute, addresses specifically those who've previously been married. Let me show you this. Why do I believe that's what it's being referred to here by the unmarried? Why do I think they're not just single people in general, but rather divorced or really even demarried, right, in this context. The term only occurs here in this chapter four times. And in notice, remember in the context here, notice, remember in verse 1, you have this introductory clause or introductory phrase, now concerning, right? That shows up again that in verse 25, introducing a new topic. Look what it says in verse 25, now concerning virgins. So the question is, who are virgins? Well, virgins are very clearly and unmistakably those who have never been married. Virgins are the category of singles that we think of when we think of devoted young adult, mostly, right? Those who've never been married before, those who've never had marital intimacy. That's the category of singles that he begins to address in verse 25. So so the conclusion is, at least the implication, is the first half of this chapter is all in relation to marriage. These are all people who have at one time been married, which is why, if you remember, in verse 12, when he says, hey, to the rest of these people, he refers to the rest of those who are married, not just the rest of anybody, because that would have included then the virgins. Right? If he just meant generically to everybody else in verse 12, that would have included the virgins. But because it's clear that when he says in verse 12 to the rest, he's talking about those who are married unequally, his mind is still in the category of people in relation to marriage. So these first three categories are those who've been previously married, those who are equally married, and then the only other category then for the rest would be those who are married to unbelievers. Does that make sense so far? That's one reason. Notice first another reason here. This category of unmarried people, they're separate from widows in verse 8, right? They're stated separately from widows. It's to the unmarried and to the widows. Now skip over to verse 34. He uses the term again. The woman who is unmarried, but this time he puts that category next to this, and the virgin. So now you have this category of people separate from virgins who've never been married before. So if this category of single people is not those who've never been married, and it's not those who are single because of their husbands have died, then who are the unmarried? They're not those who've never been married, and they're not those whose spouses have died. I mean, the only category of single people left is those whose spouses have left them. But here's the nail for me in the coffin is verse 11. Notice, Paul uses this word to describe the one who has divorced her husband. Verse 11, but if she does leave, she must remain, here it is, unmarried. So, for all those reasons, I believe that when Paul is pairing these two terms together in this first category, the unmarried or the demarried or the divorced and the widows, he has in mind single people who have lost their spouses due to divorce or death. That's who he's talking to in verses 8 and 9. Does that make sense so far? Are you guys tracking with me? I know this is like super heady, detailed Bible study stuff. So think about that then. Paul is addressing now those who are previously married but are now single and have all of a sudden come to Christ. That's who he's talking about. To those who are in that state of singleness because they've lost a spouse and now they've come to Christ. What do they do? What do they do? Because think about what we just got done talking about in verses 1 through 11. In light of Paul's instructions in verses 1 through 7, right, where he's talking about marital intimacy as being such a blessing and a protection that you need to guard that and keep having that with your spouse. And for the Christian who's had that before in the past and now doesn't have that, they're probably thinking, what do I do? What predicament am I in? And likely they were wondering, well, then do I need to get married again? And notice what Paul's answer is. Not necessarily. You see, the command or the rule given here in this first category, again, where Paul begins is remain as you are, remain in the condition in which you came to Christ, if possible. And so notice, verse 8, I say to this category, unmarried and widows, that it's good that for them to remain even as I. Some would actually see this as a reason why we would say maybe Paul might have had a spouse in a previous life. In fact, it was very common, in fact, expected of Pharisees to have married. And so some would speculate because he says, remain as I in this category, some have thought it's likely that Paul's wife either died or left him when he came to Christ. And so, I don't know, the text doesn't say, you can ask him in heaven. But notice, it's so interesting here that Paul's counsel to these people is, you don't have to get married. Which tells me singleness, guys, at least in principle, is not a condition to be feared or necessarily avoided. But Paul says to these people, look, you don't have to get married, even in light of what he just said in verses 1 through 7. He says, you have a choice. In fact, it's good. It could be considered good that you don't get married in some cases, right? Now, he's not directly dealing with the kind of singleness that we think of when we think of, I've never been married. He'll deal with that later in verses 25 through 35. And when he does, he's actually going to fill out some of the reasons why he says here that it's good, potentially good for you to remain single. When he comes to focus on that issue of singleness, he'll give more reasons there for why it's good. But now he just says that there are clearly circumstances in which it can be good and beneficial for some Christians not to get, and I would say it this way, remarried, if they can help it. By the way, he's already used the phrase, it is good, in verse 1, to affirm, with qualifications, of course, the general principle, even if he's quoting the Corinthians there, that sexual abstinence or celibacy was not wrong or sinful. Remember, he said it's good for a man not to touch a woman. I mean, I think he meant that. He does qualify it, of course, there. But in some cases, that's a good condition. It's okay. You don't have to be remarried, and you don't have to protect yourself by this kind of a relationship all the time. God can give the grace for you to battle that temptation as a single person. Do you guys believe that? You should. Marriage is not the only solution to temptations to immorality. We see that very clearly here. So that's his baseline, but look, notice verse 9. And every single one of these categories, by the way, you have a rule that he begins with, but and then an exception that he addresses in the by the way of a conditional clause. Notice the exception here in this verse 9. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry, which is actually a command. Allow them to do that. For it is better, here's the reason, for it's better to marry than to burn with passion. Now, this has been so misunderstood by so many people, so we have to clarify this here as well. I think we're already clarified a little bit. We're already helped a little bit by even understanding the category of person that Paul is addressing here, right? It's already helpful to know that these people, these are people who've been married before. These are people who've had regular intimacy with their spouses and now do not. That's helpful. But notice, to prove that neither singleness nor marriage is the issue, Paul here turns around and actually encourages or even commands marriage in the case of other people who find themselves in this condition. And the condition is literally, if they do not have self-control. We have to explain what that means. And in such cases, Paul says they should marry, and he gives a reason, because it's better to marry than to burn. You know, how this has been understood, misunderstood, and read by many people, I think, as you can imagine, when you hear that language, is that this is referring to someone who's just struggling with lust and sinning all over the place, the sin of immorality, and can't control their sinful desires. And so Paul's advice is just for that person to get married, because that's the solution. And we've already talked about, we've already hinted at even earlier in chapter 6 and even in up in chapter, in verses 1 through 7, that that's not what Paul is saying. But I want to show you why that's a misunderstanding of this verse. First, nowhere does Paul mention that this person is guilty of sexual immorality, which is porneia in two chapters where he's clearly speaking strongly against immorality, porneia. That is not in this verse. This person has not committed that sin. You can't find it here. Nowhere in this verse is there even an implication that this person has sinned in the sin of sexual lust in his heart and mind, which is a different word, epithumia. That's not here either. So that's the first observation we have to make. But second, maybe more significant, the words he uses here in context describe someone who has a strong and distracting, and here's how I would put it, legitimate desire and concern for marriage and marital intimacy. And I would even add, because they've experienced it before. The word here, notice, for self-control, here's where we go wrong. It's not being used by Paul here to say that this guy's constantly giving in to his sinful desires. That's not how Paul's using this term here. In context of 1 Corinthians, to lack self-control does not necessarily imply sin and failure. Let me prove that to you. Go to two chapters later, 1 Corinthians 9. Flip over there for a moment. The same word is used in verse 25 of 1 Corinthians 9 to speak of what an athlete must do to lay aside normal distractions of life that are not necessarily sinful in order to win the prize. You see chapter 9, verse 24, actually start in verse 24. Start in verse 24. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises, here's our term, self-control in all things. What is the context? Paul is describing a life that is trimmed down for gospel ministry and gospel focus. And he's saying, here's what I want you to do. Focus your life. Get rid of the distractions that include things, listen, that aren't sinful. How do I know that? Because in the context of chapter 9 earlier, some of those things include for Paul marriage. Some of those things include for Paul things like receiving a wage and getting paid by churches. Is that sinful? No. But exercising self-control in this context, Paul says, requires you lay those things aside because they're just extra, and that you run the race with laser focus. That's how he's using this term. So we let me show it, verse 5 of this chapter. Paul speaks of refraining from what is his legitimate right to take on a believing wife, as the rest of the apostles, including Peter, actually had. That's interesting, isn't it? Was that wrong for Peter to do? No. So in this sense, we could say Peter lacked self-control that Paul had. Does that mean Peter was in sin? No. Same with verse 15. He just says, look, I've used none of these things. This is the self-control that Paul is referring to. Okay, so back to our context. So then, for Paul to say, if you don't have this kind of self-control, if you can't do that like I can, if you can't focus with laser focus, undistracted attention, if you can't lay aside these rights to pursue gospel ministry in this way and effectiveness as a single person, then get married. He's not describing someone who's just failing to control their sinful lusts. Now you say, well, what about the verb to burn? I mean, that sounds like really bad. I mean, right? that sounds like sinful passion. Well, let me show you another place that Paul uses that word to burn to the Corinthians. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he uses the same word there. In verse 29, we'll just begin in verse 28. This is that laundry list that Paul said he went through as an apostle. And he said that apart from, after listing all the external hardships, right, apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure on me and concern for all the churches. Listen to this, verse 29. Who is weak without my being weak? Who is led into sin without my, here's the word, burning, without my intense concern? Listen, that is not talking about a sinful desire. That is a good translation. It's intense concern. In fact, like I read in verse 28, Paul uses this word for a different word for this worry and concern there. Do you see that? Concern for all the churches. That's a different word, but that word is used, okay, back to our context. Okay, you're getting exercise, your fingers are getting worked out here. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, back to our context, that word for concern is used all over the paragraph, verse 32 through 35. Let's read it together. But I want you to be free from, here it is, concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is, here's the word, concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But the one who's married is concerned about the things of the world, that she may please her husband. This I say for your own benefit. Listen to the emphasis here. Not to put a restraint on you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. That is what Paul is talking about. He's not talking about a burning of failure and a burning of lustful passion. He's talking about an intense concern that is distraction from service to the Lord in the way that Paul can give when he's not married, when he's laid aside his right to marry someone. Does that make sense so far, guys? And Paul's point here then is not to say that if you're constantly struggling with sinful desires, hopefully it's clear by now, you should just get married. That is not at all what Paul is saying here. Paul wants them to be free from concern and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. And he says, if you can't do that, if your mind is just on marriage because what? You've been married before. Then just get married again. That's okay. That's not a second-class Christian. And one more thing. Look back at verse 5. I mean, think about it. The similar idea was already referred to by Paul in this very context. That verse 5 would say, there's a reason why, as married people, you don't deprive one another except for agreement for a short time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, even in that deliberate time of pause. That shouldn't be long. Notice, he uses the same idea, because of your lack of self-control. That doesn't imply sin has been committed. That just implies the temptation that's always lurking. And so you carry that down into someone who's lost their husband, lost their wife, and they're probably thinking, man, that's a difficult spot, right? Not just is this a short agreement to abstain for a time with someone who is my spouse? I actually have lost my spouse. And so Paul says, then that person should just get married. Should get married again. So I hope that's clear, that what Paul is talking about here is remarriage. He's addressing a category of people who've been previously married, and he says, it's good if you can remain as you are. In God's providence, he saved you, and he saved you in that moment. Not a moment before, not a moment after. And it's good that you remain as you are. But if you can't remain undistracted like that, then just get married. You know, this is helpful for even counseling scenarios, right? Where, well, I threw out that scenario earlier where the question is, well, man, prior to Christ, I had all these marriages. I was even adulterous. In that situation, what do you tell someone who's been divorced many times and then finally comes to Christ and they're asking you, can I get married again? Based on this verse, I would say yes. I would say, yeah, that's the category that you're in. You're in the unmarried category. You've come to Christ now and you've repented of all of that. You're a new creature. You can remain as you are if you want, but you can actually remarry now as a believer. Isn't that a sweet grace? from God to be able to wipe all that clean and say, I start afresh. The Lord is kind. Some implications here that I was just thinking of for this first category, these first two verses. Again, one of them being singleness is not a lesser state of existence. That's clear here. Paul says there is a situation in which it's good for that person to remain single. But I think maybe even more significantly, I just was thinking about marriage and intimacy is a powerful thing when it's awakened, isn't it? You just think about that in what this text is saying, that it's likely that, and probably more likely, that those who've experienced that regular intimacy in a previous marriage, that's been awakened, and now it's gone. That's the person Paul's talking to. And that's tough. I mean, in fact, this isn't the only place where Paul would encourage a person like that to remarry. 1 Timothy 5, you don't have to turn there, but just write it down if you're curious. 1 Timothy 5, 11 through 14, Paul will tell young widows there to do the same thing. And it's interesting that he even distinguishes there between young widows and old widows. Like he just said, yeah, old widows, they're likely to have, their passions are probably not as raging. But he actually says, young widows, look, you should just remarry again. Because of their strong desires. Why? Because they've experienced that in marriage already. I just was also thinking back in 1 Corinthians 6. You know, when we were talking about verses 16 through 18, where Paul's warning against immorality, and he's saying, look, immorality is a unique kind of sin. It joins your body with the prostitute. It's you need to flee that, because every other sin, verse 18, that a man commits is outside of the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. I was thinking about the uniqueness. Here's why that is so devastating, because it is awakening. It is using what God intended to only be used in marriage. And just even in our verses tonight proves that once that is kindled, it's very hard to put back in and to put away. That's a problem. That's why he warns against it. It can be particularly problematic. It's why Solomon says in Song of Solomon, it's part of his refrain three times, do not arouse or awaken love until she so desires. That's wise counsel. Because Solomon knew that for those who've tasted that in marriage, that is a great blessing, and that's the context in which it needs to stay. And when that is taken away, it's difficult. It's distracting. It can be hard. And so here he advises for those people to remarry. And then lastly, of course, the implication that I was bringing out is that, and it's more of a negative one, sort of disproving how this verse has been used by many. Guys, sexual sin, struggle with lust, failure in immorality is no reason to get married. That is not what Paul is advocating here. Far from it. So, well, I told you we would only get through one, but maybe we can pause here. Just here, I'll turn this off and see if you guys have any questions.